Yes, that's what Ray Kurzweil, the famous computer programmer and a futurist author, who's a science fiction writer, that's what he was talking about this past week, that potentially we could have access to millions of virtual worlds and open up millions of new nodes in our brain. And in fact, even when we leave this physical body, we'll be able to download our consciousness and experience millions, perhaps billions, of other virtual worlds and realities. Now, that might seem like a really wonderful thing to some people, but I can't even sit down and watch the television, so you're not going to get me into a virtual world. You know,
well, I've got the Matrix, you know, but people wanted that when the Avatar was released, and that, you know, people had like depression symptoms afterwards, allegedly, because they couldn't be in that world or whatever. Remember that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you take away, oh my goodness, I have to tell you, Henrik, are you familiar with the TED Talks?
Sure. Oh yeah.
Okay. I was privy to watch TED Global a couple weeks ago. And, you know, what we're talking about right now, they're pushing a lot of these ideas through TED. They've gathered all the really intelligent, nice people and have them caged into this little sort of, to me, it looks like a corporate cult. But they're promoting a certain set of ideas through there. Obviously, the global warming, the climate change, that's just on the surface. But what they're really promoting through TED, through a lot of these speakers, is the sort of glorification of like the iPhone, the smartphone for one, as your new companion. And also they're glorifying and promoting, in a way, cybernetic transhumanism. And I saw this with a couple of speakers in a row. And they were talking about the iPhone like it was the greatest technological invention ever, and that DARPA had provided some of the seed funding for it, and how wonderful that was, and therefore DARPA should be part owner of Apple. And everyone in the TED Talk, before the speakers began, they all had their iPhones out. Everyone's fingers were on the screen doing what they do on the screen of the iPhone. And then they watched the speakers, and they're talking about the iPhone. And they're just surrounded by this iPhone. And I'm feeling around in my pocket, and I pull my phone out. And I've got a little Nokia, which is a tiny little thing, but I love it because I only have to charge it once a week. It's brilliant. It doesn't have any sort of smartphone features at all. And I've missed the iPhone revolution completely. And I'm very much active online. I'm on social networks, and I'm on all this stuff. But I don't have an iPhone. I probably have more time to spend in the real world than most people with iPhones do, because I don't have one. But then I thought to myself, this idea of technology and progress, how wonderful and how fantastic these smartphones are, and because of these smartphones, now IBM's come out with the next generation of chip to take on the huge data requirements to make this iPhone perform in better and better ways. And I thought to myself, if the iPhone or the smartphone, and to have all these expensive microwave, potentially dangerous relay stations for data transfer, using us essentially as a human guinea pig to test it out, the effects of it over the next few years. But anyway, if the iPhone had come out, Henrik, in 2020 rather than in 2008 or whenever it came out, would the world be that much of a different place? I mean, having yourself hooked up on a handset, is it that much of an advantage for mankind? Is it really revolutionary? Or is it just another layer of convenience that has been sped along the timeline to this point in history, when in fact it doesn't really have a whole lot of bearing in terms of benefit on the human race?
Well, and it's, I mean, absolutely, you're right. And we should always put that in perspective and see how things are, how, you know, the human race is transforming, and a certain of these technologies are literally viral. There's like a virus that spreads with them. And at the same time, you know, kind of coupled with that, just what you said as well, for me, it's a lot about, okay, but what do you do with it? What, you know, what kind of content do you do? Are you learning with it? Are you going forward, et cetera? But I think we all could do good from just disconnected from it now and then and actually get some perspective. But that's another level, I feel, of the maybe unintentional side effect, but the fact that we never get this perspective. It's always connectivity. It's always there. It's never peace and quiet, never one moment of being disconnected for many people these days.
Yeah, I get withdrawal. I mean, I used to get withdrawal symptoms if I wasn't on my website posting or whatever, but that's a different sort of...
At least that's a positive drive, because you have a drive there, you have an intention of, you know, spreading information, good information, proper, getting the truth out. You know, that's a healthy drive on top of all of this, you know. But if you're on there, you know, looking at what do people do online? Look at porn, and they, you know, look at gossip and, you know, sports results and everything else. Just, you know, it's entertainment. It's just occupying the mind, basically.
Yeah. I mean, look at the big corporations like, you know, we have Apple, and obviously the social networks that are playing a big role in our lives. We're talking about Facebook. There's a whole virtual community there. And of course, Google has large portions of this online activity wired into its network. But Microsoft goes very much under the radar these days, but they're very active in the background as far as infrastructural stuff. Now, if you're talking about let's talk about the surveillance state for a minute. A lot of people are not aware that Microsoft did a joint venture with the NYPD, the New York Police Department, and they've designed this thing which they call, the nickname of it's Gotham City. But essentially what it is it's a high-tech security system, which is multi-angle surveillance, analyzing the data in real time. It's called the Domain Awareness System. It's created by Microsoft. It even says that this system can predict a criminal event before it happens through the use of complex analysis and algorithms and so forth.
Really?
And this is in play right now in New York City. It's implemented right now. Okay?
Interesting.
So this is working as we speak. It's very dark in its scope. And if you look at Microsoft, I'll give you an example. Microsoft have got their hands dirty on many occasions. You know, the Stuxnet virus.
Yeah.
I know how that was delivered. It wasn't delivered by a thumb drive. It wasn't delivered by a hack. Basically, it was delivered through the pipeline, through Microsoft updates, into the computers in an Iranian nuclear facility.
Huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
Down the Microsoft pipeline. A lot of people don't know that.
It's just funny. I don't want to interrupt you, pick up on that, but it's just funny to think about that, these, you know, global or like international enemies and different countries or conglomerates, but they are all still like tied to Microsoft Windows, you know, all of them. it's kind of hilarious to me in a way. But pick up where you were, where you're living off there.
No, absolutely. And, you know, that's an incredible amount of power that corporation has.
That's right.
They've got the keys to almost every, well, not almost every, but say 80% of the global desktop, 90% maybe of the global desktop computers.
Yeah.
Microsoft had the keys, the backdoor keys into. And so, you know, what are the people in Microsoft, what sort of deals are they doing with the intelligence agencies? What sort of deals are they doing with the NSA? Well, we know they're doing deals. They sit together at Bilderberg every year. Craig Mundy has been at Bilderberg. He's the head of Microsoft Strategic Strategies. He's been there for the last 6 or 7 years, and he's in there with Eric Schmidt. He's in there with all the top
Google guys. Here. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, they sit down and they're aware of each other's business, and they have a level of familiarity at the highest levels in those organizations between the corporates and the government. And that, by definition, is global fascism. Okay?
That's right. So when they talk about cybersecurity, as allegedly was a big topic on this year's Bilderberg conference, what are they really talking about there, do you think?
They're talking about erecting their digital rings of steel, cordoning off various markets. One thing I know they were definitely talking about at Bilderberg, because, you know, Bilderberg was really interesting. This was the year that the Bilderberg Group came out in public. They released their guest list to the London Telegraph in advance. That had never been done before in terms of releasing the guest list to the mainstream media. It had always been supplied through a leak in Bilderberg to people like Jim Tucker from American Free Press, who sadly passed away in April.
Yeah.
But this was Bilderberg's coming out year, and it was very interesting. It happened in London. I opted out this year. I didn't go. I decided to stay in Beirut. But I did have an opportunity to go, and I didn't want to go because I sensed that it would be a media circus in the wrong ways, and I didn't want to be there. Let's put it that way. all the attention in Bilderberg this year was on obviously Alex Jones being there, and very little of the people there were concerned with what was actually going on inside. But a few very resourceful people from the UK column and a little outfit called Liberty Tactics in the UK, they went as soon as the hotel was open to the public. They went in and started looking around and accidentally wandered into a banqueting suite where they hadn't taken down all the presentation materials. And lo and behold, it was a presentation by the Thomson Reuters to the Bilderberg group. And the title of this presentation was Unleashing the Power of the Unified Global Financial Markets. Okay. You have to remember, Thomson Reuters was integrally involved in the LIBOR scandal. And the head, British Banking Association head and the Barclays head, his name is Marcus Aegeus, and he's a Bilderberger, and he was there this year, okay? And Thomson's used to report the LIBOR rate, okay? So they were part of that chain of the LIBOR scandal. Of course, they're on the innocent side, supposedly, right?
Yeah.
They've now done the same thing with the global currency markets. We've discovered through Bloomberg reports a few weeks ago that the global currency markets are as rigged as the lending interest rates with regards to the LIBOR scandal, and Thomson Reuters is at the center of that as well. Okay? So there we've discovered a piece of the Bilderberg agenda going in with the global tax regime. We took a lot of photos of some of the people coming in and out, and we got a piece of the agenda after the Bilderberg meeting, which is a hell of a great job by that team in the UK. And I have to tip my hat to them for that, because they've given us a glimpse into a few different things that, you know, allowing us to see what's behind the scenes there. So I thought that was fantastic. And they do not get enough credit from the masses.
Yeah, it was Malcolm Massey, Neil Foster. I think we've had Neil with us before, if that's the same Neil Foster.
Yes, that's Neil. Neil from Sovereign Independence.
That's right. And then Mark Anderson as well.
And Mark Anderson from AFP. So, but that's a really important one. And, you know, people look at Thomson Reuters. It's an everyday brand. The brand is everywhere. And one would not question if they were involved in any of these international financial scandals, which are basically scams, in order to rig the game, basically, so that those who have a lot of money to gamble can make big returns, okay? And then, you know, obviously, the small players get wiped out. It's exactly the same as some gambling dens I've been to. But there you go.
Game is rigged. The house always wins. Yeah, that's the score. And taking out all the competition, you know, again, it's like people should be concerned with the equality this quality should be there is on, you know, the infrastructure that exists for everyone to equally have the ability to, you know, to make money or to work for themselves and everything else, as opposed to at least directly what people have or don't have, and then, you know, according to those rules, trying to level the playing field. Because again, as we know, a lot of things are being in the liberal agenda, it's being used with terminology, it's targeting solely your emotions, it's about equality and things that sound good. But many of these people who talk like that are some of the biggest predators out there, and they use this lingo because it lowers people's guards, it makes them not think right, and it's a very clever strategy of how they get people to just go along with an agenda which is completely antithetical to what most people would actually go along with in the beginning.
Absolutely. You know, that's how they roll out these problem reaction solution scenarios that they roll out is someone's going to have a solution at the end that seems to be more equitable for everybody in general, when in fact what it is, it is very much about killing the competition. It's about eliminating choice. So there's few and fewer choices. The U.S. housing market and the banking collapse is a perfect example. The big banks were able to garner trillions in free money from the government in terms of bailouts, but a lot of press coverage was not given to all the small banks that were caught up in this contagion and who collapsed. So these are sort of local mortgage brokers, local banks, and regional and sub-regional areas. They're gone, many of them. You can look at the same pattern in agriculture with farming, the same exact thing happening. where only the big corporate farmers can afford to operate. So it's a running theme across multiple sectors. The farming thing is huge. Obviously, you have companies like Monsanto who are providing the seeds on one side and the chemicals that germinate those seeds on the other in the form of fertilizer. And also they have the legal muscle to enforce patent regulations and legislation and so forth. So small farmers can't afford to be in business. They can't take on the big guys. And so they come and they buy them out. So we're seeing smaller and smaller number of small farmers, mom and pop farmers. And the state is coming in to legislate growing your own food in a very aggressive way, especially in America and in Europe right now.
Yeah, it's unbelievable what is going on, and it's excellent that we can, of course, be here and talk about it in detail, Patrick. There is one point I think we should end on. I want to get some of your comments on this, another item that's been in the news recently. Michael Hastings, the Rolling Stones reporter, died at 33 years old in what's being said to be a car crash, pretty much. He was driving his 2013 Mercedes C25 or C250, rather. And he has an interesting past, of course, Michael Hastings, because he was part of the, he wrote that article called The Runaway General about McChrystal and basically, you know, managed to get him socked because of that. He was getting ready to release something. Allegedly, before he died in the car crash, he had sent some emails about being worried that he was, you know, tracked basically by the FBI. But one of the most interesting clues that came up most recently, he was going to read a little bit about this here from the Huffington Post, said, according to a prominent security analyst, technology exists that could have allowed someone to hack his car, Michael Hastings' car. Former U.S. National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism, Richard Clark, told the Huffington Post that what is known about the single vehicle crash is consistent with a car cyber attack, Clark said. There's reason to believe that intelligence agencies for major powers, including the United States, know how to remotely seize control of a car. And it, of course, goes on from there and kind of details some of this story for it. But were you aware of some of Michael Hastings' work, Patrick? And do you think it's possible that he was taken out for the very reasons of him being very critical of, again, more of the surveillance that was going on of Americans and, the whole story, basically, that this is how they're running the show now, by just assassinating and taking out people like, what was the other oppositional to CISPA and SOPA? Aaron Schwartz. Thank you. Exactly. Same scenario, possibly a different, accident, quote unquote, that happened there. But again, interesting. People are being taken out.
Yeah, that's a plausible speculative analysis in terms of remote control of the car. A lot of people believe that's how Princess Diana died in the tunnel in Paris. Was that car was commandeered and ran into the side of the road. And with regards to Hastings, he's working for the Rolling Stone. And, I mean, McChrystal was a big guy, okay? This wasn't a small guy. He was a big guy in terms of the military-industrial complex. Probably McChrystal had, it probably still has anyway, a lot of lucrative future opportunities. Because of his position and the people he knows and the experience he has. And that's kind of a little bit been railroaded a bit by some of the exposure regarding some of the stuff Hastings did on him, drunken conversations at bars and so forth. Now, I'm sure Michael Hastings made a few enemies there, but more than likely, if Hastings was in danger, it would be over something that he knew. Because, you know, we have a federal government in America that has a track record of targeting media, journalists, press, to get information, to find out who their sources are. And we've already learned that out in the open with the AP scandal. And the AP scandal in America, a lot of people missed that one. The Department of Justice went in and grabbing phone records between this time and that time, and who knows what else. They're looking for information that the press had, probably confidential sources. In particular, it was about a Yemeni bomb cell, a terrorist bomb cell, that the AP had a story on, and they had a source. Now, it turns out that this Yemeni bomber cell, John Brennan, who's being nominated as the new director of the CIA, was forced to admit in front of Congress that that Yemeni bombing cell that AP was looking into, the key guy, and maybe this is what AP found out, and Brennan had to spill it to let it out, the key guy, the central, the trigger man, the bomber, was a U.S. informant who they groomed for that position. That was the central story with the AP Department of Justice intimidation of the press and spying on the press, okay?
Yeah.
So we have a federal government in America that has a track record of hounding press and journalists and either jailing them or spying on them and stealing their information, okay? So what did Michael Hastings have? What did Hastings have that he hasn't released yet? What did Hastings know? And he probably knew a fair bit, considering the sort of level of stuff he was covering. Now, the Rolling Stone is still it's still a kind of a corporate entity. I don't know who actually owns them, but I would say that they might be in the kind of corporate octopus somewhere with a bigger company. I'm not sure if they're completely independent or not, but I'm sure you can look that up. But, you know, Hastings driving the latest Mercedes on 100 or 200 grand a year or whatever, I'm not sure what they pay these guys. But if he did have enemies, when you're being paid by the company and you're part of the machine and you're digging into the power pit a little bit too deep, well then, because you're getting all the benefits, you're seen as fair game by your enemies. That's the difference between Michael Hastings and some blogger who's doing it in his spare time, but might be breaking an equally big story that tend to be ignored by the establishment. But Michael Hastings clearly was not being ignored. He was being watched. He was being tracked. But did you discover anything in any of your reading of this story that you thought you could draw a really clear line, a clear thread to say that, yeah, he was definitely in the middle of something big? Because I didn't look that closely into it in terms of I didn't read everything. I just read
A bit about it. There is more, exactly. There's more I need to look into as well to try to get a hint of what he was onto and what possibly could have been some of the new stuff that he was working on. But I know that he was outspoken recently, of course, in the media and allegedly working on something that was connected, I think, in some manner or capacity to the surveillance state, basically. But definitely need to do more on that. But there's other cases as well, as you know, Patrick, in history where this happens. Journalists like Gary Webb, who wrote for San Jose Mercury News. Hunter S. Thompson was speculated. He was working on something on 9/11. He got, shot twice, I think, in the head with a shotgun or something like that. They said he killed himself. Vince Foster, the whole, Clinton story and everything else. It's like, it's on repeat, many of these stories.
Yeah, no, definitely your life's in danger in certain parts of, if you're very high profile. And also, look at Aaron Schwartz. I mean, this kid was no slouch.
No.
He was a genius, actually. And he's one of the new generation of really, really savvy dot-com innovators, software engineers, and also he had a bit of a social justice streak running through him in terms of he understood that the internet might be in danger of being controlled, regulated, or shut down in certain ways. And Aaron Schwartz, one would look at Aaron Schwartz and young people would emulate his success and certainly listen to anything he had to say. And he came across to me as a very nice young man and seems to have come from a good family. Just really smart, and he's a great innovator. That's why he's successful. I mean, he's one of the founders of Reddit.
That's right.
Along with one of the guys who wrote the original RSS software, I think.
Hastings was involved in Reddit too, I think.
No, really?
Yeah, one second now. Let me look that up.
That's interesting.
Yeah, Michael Hastings. He was one of the founders, basically, of Reddit as well.
You just gave me ammunition from my next article.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's going on here. Wait a minute. I don't jump ahead of myself here. Or was it BuzzFeed? Let's see here. I don't want to give you the wrong story here, so let me see here.
Well, I'll check it out. But Hastings was involved in some big stuff online as well.
Yeah.
Very talented guy, obviously. Very smart guy. Very savvy. maybe had a social justice streak running through him as well, like Aaron Schwartz did.
Yeah.
Certainly Aaron Schwartz's parents don't think that he killed himself. And he was being spied on, and he was being targeted by the DOJ. That's on record. So, you know, mea culpa. Who's going to take credit for killing somebody like that? Nobody. It's going to be up to us to be able to dig and find out the truth one day, hopefully.
Yeah.
But we do right now have people in power that are dirty, that play dirty and are gaming the system in their favor and also using their positions of authority to crush dissent. And this is something that used to be reserved exclusively, in our minds anyway, to places like Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union and Red China. And, of course, it's always been happening in our societies under the radar as such. But now the difference is, Henrik, it's happening in public.
Yeah.
Now they're being quite bullshy about it and very unapologetic about it. That's the difference. That is the difference in the paradigm between the past and now. That's the liberals will say, oh, it's, you know, there's always been government corruption and oh, people are always corrupt and it's just, you know, it's a byproduct of being in a free society. You know? But I'm telling you, the paradigm is not the same as it was 20 years ago. It's very different now. People are very upfront about taking sides on this. And of course, the state, the government, the corporations, they don't care about the rights of, you know, the other thing with the NSA surveillance thing is they're doing this in the cooperation with the big players like Google and Facebook are handing the stuff over. And also they're selling the data to the government and the government's collecting data and selling it back to the Googles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We outlined that on 21st Century Wire in an article. Clearly it's a fact. So they're all involved in this kind of trade, if you will, of data and information. So it's happening out in the open, Henrik, and that's the difference in what's happening today. And that's the thing that's probably most shocking. My question is, what are people going to do about it? How hard will people push back? Are a lot of people even aware of the seriousness of the situation right now in terms of, you know, kind of the police state, the Orwellian state has come out of the closet. It's in the open now. It's not being done in the Rockefeller think tanks behind closed doors anymore, the Rand Corporation or whatever. It's now being done out in public in full view, in total complicit and compliance between the corporations and the government,
yeah,
rolling stuff out. So what will the public push back against this at some point? Or is this system so pernicious and so massive in its scope that it can't be stopped? I'm a believer that the corporate side you can't do a whole lot about, but on the political side, there's still a chance to do something. But it's very, very difficult right now.
Yeah, it is. They're doing live data tests, it seems, if they have supercomputers running everything else at their disposal. They're making a lot of the experimentation, almost, it feels like. That's, you know, when I see the uprisings, as we talked about in the beginning, of the you know, using the social networks and what happened in Egypt and Libya and everything else, it seems like a live, they're doing it in real time, if I can put it in that way. So it's very interesting. And also, by the way, before I take that step in the wrong direction there, Michael Hastings was involved in BuzzFeed. He was a reporter for them, so I confused that with Reddit for some reason. So no need to follow on that trail, Patrick.
So very interesting, though. Keep an eye out on the Hastings. Obviously, if you discover anything interesting, do send it my way.
Will do.
But yeah, just also, you know, great job with Red Ice. Website's looking great. You guys seem to have a steady flow of excellent guests. So I think it's a great operation you guys are running there.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Patrick. And we appreciate your work, of course, because it's essential. We have geniuses like you who can come on the show and break down some of these global events for us. So we couldn't do without you, Patrick. Why don't we end with you giving out your websites again and let us know if there's any way that people can, you know, support you or get involved in your work in any way, or, you know, hook you up with on social networks or whatever, something like that.
Yeah, I think if anyone's listening, if you want to do us a big favor, go to our 21st Century Wire Facebook page and hit like. And there's a great news feed that we're doing there on a daily basis. And these are stories that you're not going to see on Infowars.com or any of the other sites. We'd try to do different stuff and get the real incisive angles on things. So 21stCenturyWire.com is our website, our YouTube channel, 21st Century Wire TV. Yeah, and I think we're going to be hopefully doing some good stuff in the coming months. Certainly, we've hit a trajectory on the upward trajectory, and we want to keep going there. And down the road, I would like to publish a magazine and have that available to our members or whatever we decide to do. But I'm a big believer that we got to get back into print and get back into things we can put in our hands. So that's something that I might be, a venture I might be going into in the fall or the winter. But in the meantime, you're going to see some great reports from the Middle East. We're going to have a film on Cyprus coming out. Might be part of a series of the European economic collapse where we're going to travel to different countries. I'm hoping that project's going to take some life in the next few months. But yeah, so there's plenty of stuff to report on, Henrik. There's plenty of things going on.
That's absolutely right. We'll keep an eye on the website, of course, in the meantime, 21stCenturyWire.com. Thank you, Patrick Henningsen, for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Henrik.
All right, that's our program for today. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back with more in just a few days. Keep an eye on redicecreations.com for more news and stories from around the world. Thank you for your support, for your membership with us, both listening and learning, and of course also enabling us to continue to analyze, investigate, and report on the most fascinating and important stories. Much more is coming. We'll talk to you in a few. Take care.